A Little Hero, written by Fyodor Dostoevsky. At that time, I was nearly 11. I had been sent in July to spend the holiday in a village near Moscow with a relation of mine called T, whose house was full of guests, 50 or perhaps more. I don't remember, I didn't count. The house was full of noise and gaiety. It seemed as though it were a continual holiday which would never end. It seemed as though our host had taken a vow to squander all his vast fortune as rapidly as possible, and he did indeed succeed, not long ago, in justifying this surmise. That is, in making a clean sweep of it all to the last stick. Fresh visitors used to drive up every minute. Moscow was close by, in sight, so that those who drove away only made room for others, and the everlasting holiday went on its course. Festivities succeeded one another, and there was no end in sight to the entertainments. There were riding parties about the environs, excursions to the forest or the river, picnics, dinners in the open air, suppers on the great terrace of the house, bordered with three rows of gorgeous flowers that flooded with their fragrance the fresh night air and illuminated the brilliant lights which made our ladies, who were almost every one of them pretty at all times, seem still more charming, with their faces excited by the impressions of the day, with their sparkling eyes, with their interchange of sprightly conversation, their peals of ringing laughter, dancing, music, singing. If the sky were overcast, tableaux vivants, charades, proverbs were arranged. Private theatricals were got up. There were good talkers, storytellers, wits. Certain persons were prominent in the foreground. Of course, backbiting and slander ran their course, as without them the world could not get on, and millions of persons would perish of boredom like flies. But as I was at that time 11, I was absorbed by very different interests, and either failed to observe these people, or, if I noticed anything, did not see it all. It was only afterwards that some things came back to my mind. My childish eyes could see only the brilliant side of the picture, and the general animation, splendour and bustle. All that, seen and heard for the first time, made such an impression upon me that for the first few days I was completely bewildered and my little head was in a whirl. I keep speaking of my age, and of course I was a child, nothing more than a child. Many of these lovely ladies petted me without dreaming of considering my age. But strange to say, a sensation which I did not myself understand already had possession of me. Something was already whispering in my heart, of which till then it had had no knowledge, no conception, and for some reason it began all at once to burn and throb, and often my face glowed with a sudden flush. At times I felt, as it were, abashed, and even resentful of the various privileges of my childish years. At other times a sort of wonder overwhelmed me, and I would go off into some corner where I could sit unseen, as though to take breath and remember something, something which it seemed to me I had remembered perfectly till then, and now had suddenly forgotten, something without which I could not show myself anywhere, and could not exist at all. At last it seemed to me as though I were hiding something from everyone, but nothing would have induced me to speak of it to anyone, because, small boy that I was ready to weep with shame. Soon, in the midst of the vortex around me, I was conscious of a certain loneliness. There were other children, but all were either much older or younger than I. Besides, I was in no mood for them. Of course, nothing would have happened to me if I had not been in an exceptional position. In the eyes of those charming ladies, I was still the little, unformed creature whom they at once liked to pet, and with whom they could play as though he were a little doll. One of them particularly, a fascinating, fair woman, with very thick, luxuriant hair such as I had never seen before and probably shall never see again, seemed to have taken a vow never to leave me in peace. I was confused, while she was amused by the laughter which she continually provoked from all around us by her wild, giddy pranks with me, and this, apparently, gave her immense enjoyment. At school, among her schoolfellows, she was probably nicknamed the Tease. She was wonderfully good-looking, and there was something in her beauty which drew one's eyes from the first moment, and certainly she had nothing in common with the ordinary modest little fair girls, white as down and soft as white mice or pastor's daughters. She was not very tall, and was rather plump, but had soft, delicate, exquisitely cut features. There was something quick as lightning in her face, and indeed she was like fire all over, light, swift, alive. Her big, open eyes seemed to flash sparks. They glittered like diamonds, and I would never exchange such blue, sparkling eyes for any black ones, were they blacker than any Andalusian orb. And indeed, my blonde was fully a match for the famous brunette whose praises were sung by a great and well-known poet who, in a superb poem, vowed by all Castile that he was ready to break his bones to be permitted only to touch the mantle of his divinity with the tip of his finger. Add to that that my charmer was the merriest in the world, the wildest giggler, playful as a child, although she had been married for the last 5 years. There was a continual laugh upon her lips, fresh as the morning rose that, with the first ray of sunshine, opens its fragrant crimson bud with the cool dewdrops still hanging heavy upon it. I remember that the day after my arrival, private theatricals were being got up. The drawing room was, as they say, packed to overflowing. There was not a seat empty, and as I was somehow late, I had to enjoy the performance standing. But the amusing play attracted me to move forwarder and forwarder, and unconsciously I made my way to the first row, where I stood at last, leaning my elbows on the back of an armchair in which a lady was sitting. It was my blonde divinity, but we had not yet made acquaintance, and I gazed, as it happened, at her marvellous, fascinating shoulders, plump and white as milk, though it did not matter to me in the least whether I stared at a woman's exquisite shoulders or at the cap with flaming ribbons that covered the grey locks of a venerable lady in the front row. Near my blonde divinity sat a spinster lady, not in her first youth, one of those who, as I chanced to observe later, always take refuge in the immediate neighbourhood of young and pretty women, selecting such as are not fond of cold-shouldering young men. But that is not the point. Only this lady, noting my fixed gaze, bent down to her neighbour and, with a simper, whispered something in her ear. The blonde lady turned at once, and I remember that her glowing eyes so flashed upon me in the half-dark that, not prepared to meet them, I started as though I was scalded. The beauty smiled. "Do you like what they are acting?" she asked, looking into my face with a shy and mocking expression. "Yes," I answered, still gazing at her with a sort of wonder that evidently pleased her. "But why are you standing? You'll get tired. Can't you find a seat?" "That's just it, I can't," I answered, more occupied with my grievance than with the beauty's sparkling eyes, and rejoicing in earnest at having found a kind heart to whom I could confide my troubles. "I have looked everywhere, but all the chairs are taken," I added, as though complaining to her that all the chairs were taken. "Come here," she said briskly, quick to act on every decision, and indeed on every mad idea that flashed on her giddy brain. "Come here, and sit on my knee." "On your knee?" I repeated, taken aback. I have mentioned already that I had begun to resent the privileges of childhood and to be ashamed of them in earnest. This lady, as though in derision, had gone ever so much further than the others. Moreover, I had always been a shy and bashful boy, and of late had begun to be particularly shy with women. "Why, yes, on my knee." "Why, don't you want to sit on my knee?" she persisted, beginning to laugh more and more, so that at last she was simply giggling, goodness knows at what, perhaps at her freak, or perhaps at my confusion. But that was just what she wanted. I flushed, and in my confusion looked round, trying to find where to escape, but, seeing my intention, she managed to catch hold of my hand to prevent me from going away, and, pulling it towards her, suddenly, quite unexpectedly, to my intense astonishment, squeezed it in her mischievous warm fingers, and began to pinch my fingers till they hurt so much that I had to do my very utmost not to cry out, and in my effort to control myself made the most absurd grimaces. I was, besides, moved to the greatest amazement, perplexity, and even horror at the discovery that there were ladies so absurd and spiteful as to talk nonsense to boys, and even pinch their fingers, for no earthly reason and before everybody. Probably my unhappy face reflected my bewilderment, for the mischievous creature laughed in my face as though she were crazy, and meantime she was pinching my fingers more and more vigorously. She was highly delighted in playing such a mischievous prank, and completely mystifying and embarrassing a poor boy. My position was desperate. In the first place I was hot with shame, because almost everyone near had turned round to look at us, some in wonder, others with laughter, grasping at once that the beauty was up to some mischief. I dreadfully wanted to scream, too, for she was wringing my fingers with positive fury just because I didn't scream, while I, like a Spartan, made up my mind to endure the agony, afraid by crying out of causing a general fuss, which was more than I could face. In utter despair, I began at last struggling with her, trying with all my might to pull away my hand, but my persecutor was much stronger than I was. At last I could bear it no longer, and uttered a shriek. That was all she was waiting for. Instantly she let me go, and turned away as though nothing had happened, as though it was not she who had played the trick, but someone else, exactly like some schoolboy, who, as soon as the master's back is turned, plays some trick on someone near him, pinches some small, weak boy, gives him a flip, a kick, or a nudge with his elbows, and instantly turns again, buries himself in his book, and begins repeating his lesson, and so makes a fool of the infuriated teacher, who flies down like a hawk at the noise. But luckily for me, the general attention was distracted at the moment by the masterly acting of our host, who was playing the chief part in the performance, some comedy of scribes. Everyone began to applaud. Under cover of the noise, I stole away and hurried to the furthest end of the room, from which, concealed behind a column, I looked with horror towards the place where the treacherous beauty was sitting. She was still laughing, holding her handkerchief to her lips, and for a long time she was continually turning round, looking for me in every direction, probably regretting that our silly tussle was over so soon, and hatching some other trick to play on me. That was the beginning of our acquaintance, and from that evening she would never let me alone. She persecuted me without consideration or conscience. She became my tyrant and tormentor. The whole absurdity of her jokes with me lay in the fact that she pretended to be head over heels in love with me, and teased me before everyone. Of course, for a wild creature as I was, all this was so tiresome and vexatious that it almost reduced me to tears, and I was sometimes put in such a difficult position that I was on the point of fighting with my treacherous admirer. My naive confusion, my desperate distress, seemed to egg her on to persecute me more. She knew no mercy, while I did not know how to get away from her. The laughter which always accompanied us, and which she knew so well how to excite, roused her to fresh pranks. But at last people began to think that she went a little too far in her jests, and indeed, as I remember now, she did take outrageous liberties with a child such as I was. But that was her character. She was a spoilt child in every respect. I heard afterwards that her husband, a very short, very fat, very red-faced man, very rich and apparently very much occupied with business, spoiled her more than anyone. Always busy and flying around, he could not stay 2 hours in one place. Every day he drove into Moscow, sometimes twice in the day, and always, as he declared himself, on business. It would be hard to find a livelier and more good-natured face than his facetious but always well-bred countenance. He not only loved his wife to the point of weakness, softness, he simply worshipped her like an idol. He did not restrain her in anything. She had masses of friends, male and female. In the first place, almost everybody liked her, and secondly, the feather-headed creature was not herself over-particular in the choice of her friends, though there was a much more serious foundation to her character than might be supposed from what I have just said about her. But of all her friends, she liked best of all one young lady, a distant relation, who was also of our party now. There existed between them a tender and subtle affection, one of those attachments which sometimes spring up at the meeting of two dispositions often the very opposite of each other, of which one is deeper, purer, and more austere, while the other, with lofty humility and generous self-criticism, lovingly gives way to the other, conscious of the friend's superiority and cherishing the friendship as a happiness. Then begins that tender and noble subtlety in the relations of such characters, love and infinite indulgence on the one side, on the other love and respect, a respect approaching awe, approaching anxiety as to the impression made on the friend so highly prized, and an eager, jealous desire to get closer and closer to that friend's heart in every step in life. These two friends were of the same age, but there was an immense difference between them in everything. In looks, to begin with, Madame M. was also very handsome, but there was something special in her beauty that strikingly distinguished her from the crowd of pretty women. There was something in her face that at once drew the affection of all to her, or rather, which aroused a generous and lofty feeling of kindliness in everyone who met her. There are such happy faces. At her side, everyone grew, as it were, better, freer, more cordial, and yet her big, mournful eyes, full of fire and vigour, had a timid and anxious look, as though every minute dreading something antagonistic and menacing. And this strange timidity at times cast so mournful a shade over her mild, gentle features, which recalled the serene faces of Italian Madonnas, that looking at her, one soon became oneself sad, as though for some trouble of one's own. The pale, thin face, in which, through the irreproachable purity of the pure, regular lines and the mournful severity of some mute, hidden grief, there often flitted the clear looks of early childhood, telling of trustful years and perhaps simple-hearted happiness in the recent past. The gentle but diffident, hesitating smile all aroused such unaccountable sympathy for her that every heart was unconsciously stirred with a sweet and warm anxiety that powerfully interceded on her behalf, even at a distance, and made even strangers feel akin to her. But the lovely creature seemed silent and reserved, though no one could have been more attentive and loving if anyone needed sympathy. There are women who are like sisters of mercy in life. Nothing can be hidden from them, nothing at least that is a sore or wound of the heart. Anyone who is suffering may go boldly and hopefully to them without fear of being a burden, for few men know the infinite patience of love, compassion, and forgiveness that may be found in some women's hearts. Perfect treasures of sympathy, consolation, and hope are laid up in these pure hearts, so often full of suffering of their own, for a heart which loves much, grieves much. though their wounds are carefully hidden from the curious eye, for deep sadness is most often mute and concealed. They are not dismayed by the depth of the wound, nor by its foulness and its stench. Anyone who comes to them is deserving of help. They are, as it were, born for heroism. Madame M. was tall, supple, and graceful, but rather thin. All her movements seemed somehow irregular. At times slow, smooth, and even dignified, at times childishly hasty. And yet, at the same time, there was a sort of timid humility in her gestures, something tremulous and defenceless, though it neither desired nor asked for protection. I have mentioned already that the outrageous teasing of the treacherous fair lady abashed me, flabbergasted me, and wounded me to the quick. But there was, for that, another secret, strange and foolish reason, which I concealed, at which I shuddered as at a skeleton. At the very thought of it, brooding, utterly alone and overwhelmed in some dark, mysterious corner to which the inquisitorial mocking eye of the blue-eyed rogue could not penetrate, I almost gasped with confusion, shame, and fear. In short, I was in love. That, perhaps, is nonsense. That could hardly have been. But why was it, of all the faces surrounding me, only her face caught my attention? Why was it that it was only she whom I cared to follow with my eyes, though I certainly had no inclination in those days to watch ladies and seek their acquaintance? This happened most frequently on the evenings when we were all kept indoors by bad weather, and when, lonely, hiding in some corner of the big drawing-room, I stared about me aimlessly, unable to find anything to do, for except my teasing ladies, few people ever addressed me, and I was insufferably bored on such evenings. Then I stared at the people round me, listened to the conversation, of which I often did not understand one word, and at that time the mild eyes, the gentle smile, and lovely face of Madame M., for she was the object of my passion, for some reason caught my fascinated attention, and the strange, vague, but unutterably sweet impression remained with me. Often for hours together I could not tear myself away from her. I studied every gesture, every movement she made, listened to every vibration of her rich, silvery, but rather muffled voice, but strange to say, as the result of all my observations, I felt, mixed with a sweet and timid impression, a feeling of intense curiosity. It seemed as though I were on the verge of some mystery. Nothing distressed me so much as being mocked at in the presence of Madame M. This mockery and humorous persecution, as I thought, humiliated me. And when there was a general burst of laughter at my expense, in which Madame M. sometimes could not help joining, in despair, beside myself with misery, I used to tear myself from my tormentor and run away upstairs, where I remained in solitude the rest of the day, not daring to show my face in the drawing-room. I did not yet, however, understand my shame nor my agitation. The whole process went on in me unconsciously. I had hardly said two words to Madame M., and indeed I should not have dared to. But one evening, after an unbearable day, I turned back from an expedition with the rest of the company. I was horribly tired, and made my way home across the garden. On a seat in a secluded avenue, I saw Madame M. She was sitting quite alone, as though she had purposely chosen this solitary spot. Her head was drooping, and she was mechanically twisting her handkerchief. She was so lost in thought that she did not hear me till I reached her. Noticing me, she got up quickly from her seat, turned round, and I saw her hurriedly wipe her eyes with her handkerchief. She was crying. Drying her eyes, she smiled to me and walked back with me to the house. I don't remember what we talked about, but she frequently sent me off on one pretext or another to pick a flower or to see who was riding in the next avenue, and when I walked away from her, she at once put her handkerchief to her eyes again and wiped away rebellious tears, which would persist in rising again and again from her heart and dropping from her poor eyes. I realized that I was very much in her way when she sent me off so often, and indeed she saw herself that I noticed it all, but yet could not control herself, and that made my heart ache more and more for her. I raged at myself at that moment, and was almost in despair, cursed myself for my awkwardness and lack of resource, and at the same time did not know how to leave her tactfully, without betraying that I had noticed her distress, but walked beside her in mournful bewilderment, almost in alarm, utterly at a loss, and unable to find a single word to keep up our scanty conversation. This meeting made such an impression on me that I stealthily watched Madame M. the whole evening with eager curiosity and never took my eyes off her. But it happened that she twice caught me unawares watching her, and on the second occasion, noticing me, she gave me a smile. It was the only time she smiled that evening. The look of sadness had not left her face, which was now very pale. She spent the whole evening talking to an ill-natured and quarrelsome old lady, whom nobody liked, owing to her spying and backbiting habits, but of whom everyone was afraid, and consequently everyone felt obliged to be polite to her. At 10 o'clock, Madame M.'s husband arrived. Till that moment I watched her very attentively, never taking my eyes off her mournful face. Now, at the unexpected entrance of her husband, I saw her start, and her pale face turned suddenly as white as a handkerchief. It was so noticeable that other people observed it. I overheard a fragmentary conversation from which I guessed that Madame M. was not quite happy. They said her husband was as jealous as an Arab, not from love, but from vanity. He was, before all things, a European, a modern man who sampled the newest ideas and prided himself upon them. In appearance, he was a tall, dark-haired, particularly thick-set man with European whiskers, with a self-satisfied red face, with teeth white as sugar, and with an irreproachably gentlemanly deportment. He was called a clever man. Such is the name given in certain circles to a peculiar species of mankind which grows fat at other people's expense, which does absolutely nothing and has no desire to do anything, and whose heart has turned into a lump of fat from everlasting slothfulness and idleness. You continually hear from such men that there is nothing they can do owing to certain very complicated and hostile circumstances which thwart their genius, and that it was sad to see the waste of their talents. This is a fine phrase of theirs, their mot d'ordre, their watchword, a phrase which these well-fed fat friends of ours bring out at every minute, so that it has long ago borders as an arrant tartufism, an empty form of words. Some, however, of these amusing creatures, who cannot succeed in finding anything to do, though indeed they never seek it, try to make everyone believe that they have not a lump of fat for a heart, but, on the contrary, something very deep, though what, precisely, the greatest surgeon would hardly venture to decide. From civility, of course. These gentlemen make their way in the world through the fact that all their instincts are bent in the direction of coarse sneering, short-sighted censure, and immense conceit. Since they have nothing else to do but note and emphasize the mistakes and weaknesses of others, and as they have precisely as much good feeling as an oyster, it is not difficult for them with such powers of self-preservation to get on with people fairly successfully. They pride themselves extremely upon that. They are, for instance, as good as persuaded that almost the whole world owes them something, that it is theirs, like an oyster which they keep in reserve, that all are fools except themselves, that everyone is like an orange or a sponge, which they will squeeze as soon as they want the juice, that they are the masters everywhere, and that all this acceptable state of affairs is solely due to the fact that they are people of so much intellect and character. In their measureless conceit, they do not admit any defects in themselves. They are like that species of practical rogues, innate Tartuffes and Falstaffs, who are such thorough rogues that at last they have come to believe that that is as it should be, that is, that they should spend their lives in knavishness. They have so often assured everyone that they are honest men, that they have come to believe that they are honest men, and that their roguery is honesty. They are never capable of inner judgment before their conscience, of generous self-criticism. For some things they are too fat. Their own priceless personality, their Baal and Moloch, their magnificent ego, is always in their foreground everywhere. All nature, the whole world for them, is no more than a splendid mirror created for the little god to admire himself continually in it, and to see no one and nothing behind himself. So it is not strange that he sees everything in the world in such a hideous light. He has a phrase in readiness for everything, and, the acme of ingenuity on his part, the most fashionable phrase. It is just these people, indeed, who help to make the fashion, proclaiming at every crossroad an idea in which they scent success. A fine nose is just what they have for sniffing a fashionable phrase and making it their own before other people get hold of it, so that it seems to have originated with them. They have a particular store of phrases for proclaiming their profound sympathy for humanity, for defining what is the most correct and rational form of philanthropy, and continually attacking romanticism. In other words, everything fine and true, each atom of which is more precious than all their mollusk tribe. But they are too coarse to recognize the truth in an indirect, roundabout, and unfinished form, and they reject everything that is immature, still fermenting and unstable. The well-nourished man has spent all his life in merrymaking, with everything provided, has done nothing himself, and does not know how hard every sort of work is, and so woe betide you if you jar upon his fat feelings by any sort of roughness. He'll never forgive you for that. He will always remember it and will gladly avenge it. The long and short of it is that my hero is neither more nor less than a gigantic, incredibly swollen bag full of sentences, fashionable phrases, and labels of all sorts and kinds. Monsieur M., however, had a speciality, and was a very remarkable man. He was a wit, good talker, and storyteller, and there was always a circle round him in every drawing-room. That evening he was particularly successful in making an impression. He took possession of the conversation. He was in his best form, gay, pleased at something, and he compelled the attention of all. But Madame M. looked all the time as though she were ill. Her face was so sad that I fancied every minute that tears would begin quivering on her long eyelashes. All this, as I have said, impressed me extremely and made me wonder. I went away with a feeling of strange curiosity and dreamed all night of Monsieur M., though till then I had rarely had dreams. Next day, early in the morning, I was summoned to a rehearsal of some tableau vivant in which I had to take part. The tableau vivant, theatricals, and afterwards a dance were all fixed for the same evening, 5 days later, the birthday of our host's younger daughter. To this entertainment, which was almost improvised, another 100 guests were invited from Moscow and from surrounding villas, so that there was a great deal of fuss, bustle and commotion. The rehearsal, or rather review of the costumes, was fixed so early in the morning because our manager, a well-known artist, a friend of our host's, who had consented through affection for him to undertake the arrangement of the tableau and the training of us for them, was in haste now to get to Moscow to purchase properties and to make final preparations for the fete, as there was no time to lose. I took part in one tableau with Madame M. It was a scene from medieval life and was called The Lady of the Castle and Her Page. I felt unutterably confused on meeting Madame M. at the rehearsal. I kept feeling that she would at once read in my eyes all the reflections, the doubts, the surmises that had arisen in my mind since the previous day. I fancied, too, that I was, as it were, to blame in regard to her, for having come upon her tears the day before and hindered her grieving, so that she could hardly help looking at me askance, as an unpleasant witness and unforgiven sharer of her secret. But, thank goodness, it went off without any great trouble. I was simply not noticed. I think she had no thought to spare for me or for the rehearsal. She was absent-minded, sad, and gloomily thoughtful. It was evident that she was worried by some great anxiety. As soon as my part was over, I ran away to change my clothes, and 10 minutes later came out on the veranda into the garden. Almost at the same time, Madame M. came out by another door, and immediately afterwards, coming towards us, appeared her self-satisfied husband, who was returning from the garden after just escorting into it quite a crowd of ladies, and there handing them over to a competent cavalière servante. The meeting of the husband and wife was evidently unexpected. Madame M., I don't know why, grew suddenly confused, and a faint trace of vexation was betrayed in her impatient movement. The husband, who had been carelessly whistling an air and with an air of profundity stroking his whiskers, now, on meeting his wife, frowned and scrutinized her, as I remember now, with a markedly inquisitorial stare. "You are going into the garden?" he asked, noticing the parasol and book in her hand. "No, into the copse," she said, with a slight flush.
"Alone?"
"With him," said Madame M., pointing to me. "I always go a walk alone in the morning," she added, speaking in an uncertain, hesitating voice, as people do when they tell their first lie.
"Hmm. And I have just taken the whole party there. They have all met there together in the flower arbor to see N. off. He is going away, you know. Something has gone wrong in Odessa. Your cousin," he meant the fair beauty, "is laughing and crying at the same time. There is no making her out. She says, though, that you are angry with N. about something, and so wouldn't go and see him off. Nonsense, of course."
"She's laughing," said Madame M., coming down the veranda steps.
"So this is your daily cavalier servant," added Monsieur M. with a wry smile, turning his lorgnette upon me. "Page!" I cried, angered by the lorgnette and the jeer, and laughing straight in his face, I jumped down the 3 steps of the veranda at one bound. "A pleasant walk," muttered Monsieur M., and went on his way. Of course I immediately joined Madame M. as soon as she indicated me to her husband, and looked as though she had invited me to do so an hour before, and as though I had been accompanying her on her walks every morning for the last month. But I could not make out why she was so confused, so embarrassed, and what was in her mind when she brought herself to have recourse to her little lie. Why had she not simply said that she was going alone? I did not know how to look at her, but, overwhelmed with wonder, I began by degrees very naively peeping into her face. But, just as an hour before at the rehearsal, she did not notice either my looks or my mute question. The same anxiety, only more intense and more distinct, was apparent in her face, in her agitation, in her walk. She was in haste, and walked more and more quickly, and kept looking uneasily down every avenue, down every path in the wood that led in the direction of the garden. And I, too, was expecting something. Suddenly, there was the sound of horses' hoofs behind us. It was the whole party of ladies and gentlemen on horseback, escorting N, the gentleman who was so suddenly deserting us. Among the ladies was my fair tormentor, of whom Monsieur M had told us that she was in tears, but characteristically she was laughing like a child and was galloping briskly on a splendid bay horse. On reaching us, N took off his hat, but did not stop, nor say one word to Madame M. Soon all the cavalcade disappeared from our sight. I glanced at Madame M. and almost cried out in wonder. She was standing as white as a handkerchief, and big tears were gushing from her eyes. By chance our eyes met. Madame M. suddenly flushed and turned away for an instant, and a distinct look of uneasiness and vexation flitted across her face. I was in the way, worse even than last time. That was clearer than day. But how was I to get away? And as though guessing my difficulty, Madame M. opened the book which she had in her hand, and colouring, and evidently trying not to look at me, she said, as though she had only suddenly realised it, "Ah! It is the second part. I've made a mistake. Please bring me the first." I could not but understand. My part was over, and I could not have been more directly dismissed. I ran off with her book and did not come back. The first part lay undisturbed on the table that morning. But I was not myself. In my heart there was a sort of haunting terror. I did my utmost not to meet Madame M., but I looked with wild curiosity at the self-satisfied person of Monsieur M., as though there must be something special about him now. I don't understand what was the meaning of my absurd curiosity. I only remember that I was strangely perplexed by all that I had chanced to see that morning. But the day was only just beginning, and it was fruitful in events for me. Dinner was very early that day, an expedition to a neighbouring hamlet to see a village festival that was taking place there had been fixed for the evening, and so it was necessary to be in time to get ready. I had been dreaming for the last 3 days of this excursion, anticipating all sorts of delights. Almost all the company gathered together on the veranda for coffee. I cautiously followed the others and concealed myself behind the third row of chairs. I was attracted by curiosity, and yet I was very anxious not to be seen by Madame M., but, as luck would have it, I was not far from my fair tormentor. Something miraculous and incredible was happening to her that day. She looked twice as handsome. I don't know how and why this happens, but such miracles are by no means rare with women. There was with us at this moment a new guest, a tall, pale-faced young man, the official admirer of our fair beauty, who had just arrived from Moscow as though on purpose to replace N, of whom rumour said that he was desperately in love with the same lady. As for the newly arrived guest, he had for a long time past been on the same terms as Benedick with Beatrice in Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. In short, the fair beauty was in her very best form that day. Her chatter and her jests were so full of grace, so trustfully naive, so innocently careless, she was persuaded of the general enthusiasm with such graceful self-confidence that she really was all the time the centre of peculiar adoration. A throng of surprised and admiring listeners was continually round her, and she had never been so fascinating. Every word she uttered was marvellous and seductive, was caught up and handed round in the circle, and not one word, one jest, one sally was lost. I fancy no one had expected from her such taste, such brilliance, such wit. Her best qualities were, as a rule, buried under the most harum-scarum wilfulness, the most schoolboyish pranks, almost verging on buffoonery. They were rarely noticed, and when they were hardly believed in, so that now her extraordinary brilliancy was accompanied by an eager whisper of amazement among all. There was, however, one particular and rather delicate circumstance, judging at least by the part in it played by Madame M.'s husband, which contributed to her success. The madcap ventured, and I must add to the satisfaction of almost everyone, or at any rate to the satisfaction of all the young people, to make a furious attack upon him, owing to many causes, probably of great consequence in her eyes. She carried on with him a regular crossfire of witticisms, of mocking and sarcastic sallies, of that most elusive and treacherous kind that, smoothly wrapped up on the surface, hit the mark without giving the victim anything to lay hold of, and exhaust him in fruitless efforts to repel the attack, reducing him to fury and comic despair. I don't know for certain, but I fancy the whole proceeding was not improvised, but premeditated. This desperate duel had begun earlier at dinner. I call it desperate because Monsieur M. was not quick to surrender. He had to call upon all his presence of mind, all his sharp wit and rare resourcefulness, not to be completely covered with ignominy. The conflict was accompanied by the continual and irrepressible laughter of all who witnessed and took part in it. That day was, for him, very different from the day before. It was noticeable that Madame M. several times did her utmost to stop her indiscreet friend, who was certainly trying to depict the jealous husband in the most grotesque and absurd guise, in the guise of a Bluebeard, it must be supposed, judging from all probabilities, from what has remained in my memory, and finally from the part which I myself was destined to play in the affair. I was drawn into it in a most absurd manner, quite unexpectedly, and, as ill luck would have it at that moment, I was standing where I could be seen, suspecting no evil, and actually forgetting the precautions I had so long practised. Suddenly, I was brought into the foreground as a sworn foe and natural rival of Monsieur M., as desperately in love with his wife, of which my persecutress vowed and swore that she had proofs, saying that only that morning she had seen in the copse. But before she had time to finish, I broke in at the most desperate minute. That minute was so diabolically calculated, was so treacherously prepared to lead up to its finale, its ludicrous denouement, and was brought about with such killing humour that a perfect outburst of irrepressible mirth saluted this last sally. And though, even at the time, I guessed that mine was not the most unpleasant part in the performance, yet I was so confused, so irritated and alarmed that, full of misery and despair, gasping with shame and tears, I dashed through two rows of chairs, stepped forward, and addressing my tormentor, cried in a voice broken with tears and indignation, "Aren't you ashamed, aloud, before all the ladies, to tell such a wicked lie? Like a small child before all these men, what will they say? A big girl like you, and married!" But I could not go on. There was a deafening roar of applause. My outburst created a perfect furore. My naive gesture, my tears, and especially the fact that I seemed to be defending Monsieur M., all this provoked such fiendish laughter that even now I cannot help laughing at the mere recollection of it. I was overcome with confusion, senseless with horror, and burning with shame, hiding my face in my hands, rushed away, knocked a tray out of the hands of a footman who was coming in at the door, and flew upstairs to my own room. I pulled out the key, which was on the outside of the door, and locked myself in. I did well, for there was a hue and cry after me. Before a minute had passed, my door was besieged by a mob of the prettiest ladies. I heard their ringing laughter, their incessant chatter, their trilling voices. They were all twittering at once, like swallows. All of them, every one of them, begged and besought me to open the door, if only for a moment, swore that no harm should come to me, only that they wanted to smother me with kisses. But What could be more horrible than this novel threat? I simply burned with shame the other side of the door, hiding my face in the pillows, and did not open, did not even respond. The ladies kept up their knocking for a long time, but I was deaf and obdurate, as only a boy of 11 could be. But what could I do now? Everything was laid bare. Everything had been exposed. Everything I had so jealously guarded and concealed. Everlasting disgrace and shame had fallen on me. But it is true that I could not myself have said why I was frightened and what I wanted to hide. Yet I was frightened of something, and had trembled like a leaf at the thought of that something's being discovered. Only till that minute I had not known what it was, whether it was good or bad, splendid or shameful, praiseworthy or reprehensible. Now, in my distress, in the misery that had been forced upon me, I learned that it was absurd and shameful. Instinctively, I felt at that time that this verdict was false, inhuman and coarse, but I was crushed, annihilated. Consciousness seemed checked in me and thrown into confusion. I could not stand up against that verdict, nor criticize it properly. I was befogged. I only felt that my heart had been inhumanly and shamelessly wounded, and was brimming over with impotent tears. I was irritated, but I was boiling with indignation and hate such as I had never felt before, for it was the first time in my life that I had known real sorrow, insult, and injury, and it was truly that, without any exaggeration. The first untried, unformed feeling had been so coarsely handled in me, a child. The first fragrant, virginal modesty had been so soon exposed and insulted, and the first and perhaps very real and aesthetic impression had been so outraged. Of course, there was much my persecutors did not know and did not divine in my sufferings. One circumstance, which I had not succeeded in analyzing till then, of which I had been, as it were, afraid, partly entered into it. I went on lying on my bed in despair and misery, hiding my face in my pillow, and I was alternately feverish and shivery. I was tormented by two questions. First, what had the wretched fair beauty seen, and in fact, what could she have seen that morning in the copse between Madame M. and me? And secondly, how could I now look Madame M. in the face without dying on the spot of shame and despair? An extraordinary noise in the yard roused me at last from the state of semi-consciousness into which I had fallen. I got up and went to the window. The whole yard was packed with carriages, saddle horses, and bustling servants. It seemed that they were all setting off. Some of the gentlemen had already mounted their horses. Others were taking their places in the carriages. Then I remembered the expedition to the village fete, and little by little an uneasiness came over me. I began anxiously looking for my pony in the yard. But there was no pony there, so they must have forgotten me. I could not restrain myself, and rushed headlong downstairs, thinking no more of unpleasant meetings or my recent ignominy. Terrible news awaited me. There was neither a horse nor seat in any of the carriages to spare for me. Everything had been arranged, all the seats were taken, and I was forced to give place to others. Overwhelmed by this fresh blow, I stood on the steps and looked mournfully at the long rows of coaches, carriages, and chaises, in which there was not the tiniest corner left for me, and at the smartly dressed ladies whose horses were restlessly curvetting. One of the gentlemen was late. They were only awaiting for his arrival to set off. His horse was standing at the door, champing the bit, pawing the earth with his hoofs, and at every moment starting and rearing. Two stable boys were carefully holding him by the bridle, and everyone else apprehensively stood at a respectful distance from him. a most vexatious circumstance had occurred, which prevented my going. In addition to the fact that new visitors had arrived, filling up all the seats, two of the horses had fallen ill, one of them being my pony. But I was not the only person to suffer. It appeared that there was no horse for our new visitor, the pale-faced young man of whom I have spoken already. To get over this difficulty, our host had been obliged to have recourse to the extreme step of offering his fiery, unbroken stallion, adding, to satisfy his conscience, that it was impossible to ride him, and that they had long intended to sell the beast for its vicious character, if only a purchaser could be found. But in spite of his warning, the visitor declared that he was a good horseman, and in any case ready to mount anything rather than not go. Our host said no more, but now I fancied that a sly and ambiguous smile was straying on his lips. He waited for the gentleman who had spoken so well of his own horsemanship, and stood, without mounting his horse, impatiently rubbing his hands and continually glancing towards the door. Some similar feeling seemed shared by the two stable boys who were holding the stallion, almost breathless with pride at seeing themselves before the whole company in charge of a horse which might any minute kill a man for no reason whatever. Something akin to their master's sly smile gleamed too in their eyes, which were round with expectation and fixed upon the door from which the bold visitor was to appear. The horse himself, too, behaved as though he were in league with our host and the stable boys. He bore himself proudly and haughtily, as though he felt that he were being watched by several dozen curious eyes, and were glorying in his evil reputation exactly as some incorrigible rogue might glory in his criminal exploits. He seemed to be defying the bold man who would venture to curb his independence. The bold man did at last make his appearance, conscience-stricken at having kept everyone waiting. Hurriedly drawing on his gloves, he came forward without looking at anything, ran down the steps, and only raised his eyes as he stretched out his hand to seize the mane of the waiting horse. But he was at once disconcerted by his frantic rearing and a warning scream from the frightened spectators. The young man stepped back and looked in perplexity at the vicious horse, which was quivering all over, snorting with anger and rolling his bloodshot eyes ferociously, continually rearing on his hind legs and flinging up his forelegs as though he meant to bolt into the air and carry the two stable boys with him. For a minute, the young man stood completely nonplussed. Then, flushing slightly with some embarrassment, he raised his eyes and looked at the frightened ladies. "A very fine horse," he said, as though to himself, "and to my thinking it ought to be a great pleasure to ride him, but do you know, I think I won't go," he concluded, turning to our host with the broad, good-natured smile which so suited his kind and clever face. "Yet I consider you are an excellent horseman, I assure you," answered the owner of the unapproachable horse, delighted, and he warmly and even gratefully pressed the young man's hand. "Just because, from the first moment you saw the sort of brute you had to deal with," he added with dignity. "Would you believe me, though I have served 23 years in the Hussars, yet I've had the pleasure of being laid on the ground 3 times thanks to that beast, that is, as often as I mounted the useless animal. Tancred, my boy, there's no one here fit for you. Your rider, it seems, must be some Ilya Muromets, and he must be sitting quiet now in the village of Kapacharova, waiting for your teeth to fall out. Come, take him away. He has frightened people enough. It was a waste of time to bring him out," he cried, rubbing his hands complacently. It must be observed that Tancred was no sort of use to his master, and simply ate corn for nothing. Moreover, the old hussar had lost his reputation for a knowledge of horseflesh by paying a fabulous sum for the worthless beast, which he had purchased only for his beauty. Yet he was delighted now that Tancred had kept up his reputation, had disposed of another rider, and so had drawn closer on himself fresh, senseless laurels. "So you are not going?" cried the blonde beauty, who was particularly anxious that her cavalier servante should be in attendance on this occasion. "Surely you are not frightened?" "Upon my word I am," answered the young man.
"Are you in earnest?"
"Why, do you want me to break my neck?"
"Then make haste and get on my horse. Don't be afraid, it is very quiet. We won't delay them. They can change the saddles in a minute. I'll try to take yours. Surely Tancred can't always be so unruly."
No sooner said than done. The madcap leaped out of the saddle and was standing before us as she finished the last sentence.
"You don't know Tancred if you think he will allow your wretched side-saddle to be put on him. Besides, I would not let you break your neck. It would be a pity," said our host, at that moment of inward gratification affecting, as his habit was, a studied brusqueness and even coarseness of speech which he thought in keeping with a jolly good fellow and an old soldier, and which he imagined to be particularly attractive to the ladies. This was one of his favourite fancies, his favourite whim, with which we were all familiar.
"Well, crybaby, wouldn't you like to have a try? You wanted so much to go," said the valiant horsewoman, noticing me and pointing tauntingly at Tancred, because I had been so imprudent as to catch her eye, and she would not let me go without a biting word, that she might not have dismounted from her horse absolutely for nothing. "I expect you are not such a such-and-such. We all know you are a hero, and would be ashamed to be afraid, especially when you will be looked at, you fine page," she added, with a fleeting glance at Madame M., whose carriage was the nearest to the entrance. A rush of hatred and vengeance had flooded my heart, when the fair Amazon had approached us with the intention of mounting Tancred, but I cannot describe what I felt at this unexpected challenge from the madcap. Everything was dark before my eyes when I saw her glance at Madame M. For an instant, an idea flashed through my mind, but it was only a moment, less than a moment, like a flash of gunpowder. Perhaps it was the last straw, and I suddenly now was moved to rage as my spirit rose, so that I longed to put all my enemies to utter confusion, and to revenge myself on all of them, and before everyone, by showing the sort of person I was. Or whether by some miracle, some prompting from medieval history, of which I had known nothing till then, sent whirling through my giddy brain images of tournaments, paladins, heroes, lovely ladies, the clash of swords, shouts, and the applause of the crowd, and amidst those shouts the timid cry of a frightened heart which moves the proud soul more sweetly than victory and fame. I don't know whether all this romantic nonsense was in my head at the time, or whether, more likely, only the first dawning of the inevitable nonsense that was in store for me in the future. Anyway, I felt that my hour had come. My heart leaped and shuddered, and I don't remember how, at one bound, I was down the steps and beside Tancred. "You think I am afraid?" I cried boldly and proudly, in such a fever that I could hardly see, breathless with excitement, and flushing till the tears scalded my cheeks. "Well, you shall see." And clutching at Tancred's mane, I put my foot in the stirrup before they had time to make a movement to stop me. But at that instant Tancred reared, jerked his head, and, with a mighty bound forward, wrenched himself out of the hands of the petrified stable boys and dashed off like a hurricane, while everyone cried out in horror. Goodness knows how I got my other leg over the horse while it was in full gallop. I can't imagine either how I did not lose hold of the reins. Tancred bore me beyond the trellis gate, turned sharply to the right, and flew along beside the fence regardless of the road. Only at that moment I heard behind me a shout from 50 voices, and that shout was echoed in my swooning heart with such a feeling of pride and pleasure that I shall never forget that mad moment of my boyhood. All the blood rushed to my head, bewildering me and overpowering my fears. I was beside myself. There certainly was, as I remember it now, something of the knight-errant about the exploit. My knightly exploits, however, were all over in an instant, or it would have gone badly with the knight, and indeed I do not know how I escaped as it was. I did know how to ride, I had been taught, but my pony was more like a sheep than a riding horse. No doubt I should have been thrown off Tancred if he had had time to throw me, but after galloping 50 paces, he suddenly took fright at a huge stone which lay across the road and bolted back. He turned sharply, galloping at full speed, so that it is a puzzle to me even now that I was not sent spinning out of the saddle and flying like a ball for 20 feet, that I was not dashed to pieces, and that Tancred did not dislocate his leg by such a sudden turn. He rushed back to the gate, tossing his head furiously, bounding from side to side as though drunk with rage, flinging his legs at random in the air, and at every leap trying to shake me off his back, as though a tiger had leaped on him and were thrusting its teeth and claws into his back. In another instant I should have flown off. I was falling, but several gentlemen flew to my rescue. Two of them intercepted the way into the open country. Two others galloped up, closing in upon Tancred, so that their horses' sides almost crushed my legs, and both of them caught him by the bridle. A few seconds later, we were back at the steps. They lifted me down from the horse, pale and scarcely breathing. I was shaking like a blade of grass in the wind. It was the same with Tancred, who was standing, his hoofs, as it were, thrust into the earth, and his whole body thrown back, puffing his fiery breath from red and streaming nostrils, twitching and quivering all over, seeming overwhelmed with wounded pride and anger at a child's being so bold with impunity. All around me I heard cries of bewilderment, surprise, and alarm. At that moment my straying eyes caught those of Madame M., who looked pale and agitated, and I can never forget that moment. In one instant my face was flooded with colour, glowed and burned like fire. I don't know what happened to me, but confused and frightened by my own feelings, I timidly dropped my eyes to the ground. But my glance was noticed. It was caught. It was stolen from me. All eyes turned on Madame M., and, finding herself unawares the centre of attention, she too flushed like a child from some naive and involuntary feeling, and made an unsuccessful effort to cover her confusion by laughing. All this, of course, was very absurd looking from outside, but at that moment an extremely naive and unexpected circumstance saved me from being laughed at by everyone, and gave a special colour to the whole adventure. The lovely persecutor, who was the instigator of the whole escapade, and who till then had been my irreconcilable foe, suddenly rushed up to embrace and kiss me. She had hardly been able to believe her eyes when she saw me dare to accept her challenge, and pick up the gauntlet she had flung at me by glancing at Madame M. She had almost died of terror and self-reproach when I had flown off on Tancred. Now, when it was all over, and particularly when she caught the glance at Madame M., my confusion and my sudden flush of colour, when the romantic strain in her frivolous little head had given a new, secret, unspoken significance to the moment, she was moved to such enthusiasm over my knightliness that, touched, joyful, and proud of me, she rushed up and pressed me to her bosom. She lifted the most naive, stern-looking little face, on which there quivered and gleamed two crystal tears, and gazing at the crowd that thronged about her, said in a grave, earnest voice, such as they had never heard her use before, pointing to me,
"Mais c'est très sérieux, messieurs, ne riez pas."
She did not notice that all were standing, as though fascinated, admiring her bright enthusiasm. Her swift, unexpected action, her earnest little face, the simple-hearted naivete, the unexpected feeling betrayed by the tears that welled in her invariably laughter-loving eyes, were such a surprise that everyone stood before her as though electrified by her expression, her rapid, fiery words and gestures. It seemed as though no one could take his eyes off her for fear of missing that rare moment in her enthusiastic face.
Even our host flushed crimson as a tulip, and people declared that they heard him confess afterwards that, to his shame, he had been in love for a whole minute with his charming guest. Well, of course, after this, I was a knight, a hero.
"Delorge! Toggenburg!" was heard in the crowd.
There was a sound of applause.
"Hurrah for the rising generation!" added the host.
"But he is coming with us. He certainly must come with us," said the beauty. "We will find him a place. We must find him a place. He shall sit beside me, on my knee. But no, no, that's a mistake." She corrected herself, laughing, unable to restrain her mirth at our first encounter. But as she laughed, she stroked my hand tenderly, doing all she could to soften me, that I might not be offended.
Of course," several voices chimed in. "He must go. He has won his place."
The matter was settled in a trice. The same old maid who had brought about my acquaintance with the blonde beauty was at once besieged with entreaties from all the younger people to remain at home and let me have her seat. She was forced to consent, to her intense vexation, with a smile and a stealthy hiss of anger. Her protectress, who was her usual refuge, my former foe and new friend, called to her as she galloped off on her spirited horse, laughing like a child that she envied her, and would have been glad to stay at home herself, for it was just going to rain, and we should all get soaked. And she was right in predicting rain. A regular downpour came on within an hour, and the expedition was done for. We had to take shelter for some hours in the huts of the village, and had to return home between 9 and 10 in the evening in the damp mist that followed the rain. I began to be a little feverish. At the minute when I was starting, Madame M. came up to me and expressed surprise that my neck was uncovered, and that I had nothing on over my jacket. I answered that I had not had time to get my coat. She took out a pin, and pinned up the turned-down collar of my shirt, took off her own neck a crimson gauze kerchief, and put it round my neck that I might not get a sore throat. She did this so hurriedly that I had not time even to thank her. But when we got home, I found her in the little drawing-room with the blonde beauty and the pale-faced young man who had gained glory for horsemanship that day by refusing to ride Tancred. I went up to thank her and give back the scarf, but now, after all my adventures, I felt somehow ashamed. I wanted to make haste and get upstairs, there at my leisure to reflect and consider. I was brimming over with impressions. As I gave back the kerchief, I blushed up to my ears as usual. "I bet he would like to keep the kerchief," said the young man, laughing. "One can see that he is sorry to part with your scarf." "That's it, that's it," the fair lady put in. "What a boy!" "Oh," she said, shaking her head with obvious vexation, but she stopped in time at a grave glance from Madame M., who did not want to carry the jest too far. I made haste to get away. "Well, you are a boy," said the madcap, overtaking me in the next room and affectionately taking me by both hands. "Why, you should have simply not returned the kerchief if you wanted so much to have it. You should have said you put it down somewhere, and that would have been the end of it." "What a simpleton! Couldn't even do that. What a funny boy!" And she tapped me on the chin with her finger, laughing at my having flushed as red as a poppy. "I am your friend now, you know. Am I not? Our enmity is over, isn't it? Yes or no?" I laughed and pressed her fingers without a word. "Oh, why are you so... why are you so pale and shivering? Have you caught a chill?" "Yes, I don't feel well." "Oh, poor fellow. That's the result of overexcitement. Do you know what? You had better go to bed without sitting up for supper, and you'll be all right in the morning. Come along." She took me upstairs, and there was no end to the care she lavished on me. Leaving me to undress, she ran downstairs, got me some tea, and brought it up herself when I was in bed. She brought me up a warm quilt as well. I was much impressed and touched by all the care and attention lavished on me. Or perhaps I was affected by the whole day, the expedition and the feverishness. As I said good night to her, I hugged her warmly,
as though she were my dearest and nearest friend, and in my exhausted state all the emotions of the day came back to me in a rush. I almost shed tears as I nestled to her bosom. She noticed my overwrought condition, and I believe my madcap herself was a little touched. "You are a very good boy," she said, looking at me with gentle eyes. "Please don't be angry with me. You won't, will you?" In fact, we became the warmest and truest of friends. It was rather early when I woke up, but the sun was already flooding the whole room with brilliant light. I jumped out of bed feeling perfectly well and strong, as though I had had no fever the day before. Indeed, I felt now unutterably joyful. I recalled the previous day and felt that I would have given any happiness if I could at that minute have embraced my new friend, the fair-haired beauty, again, as I had the night before. But it was very early, and everyone was still asleep. Hurriedly dressing, I went out into the garden, and from there into the copse. I made my way where the leaves were thickest, where the fragrance of the trees was more resinous, and where the sun peeped in most gaily, rejoicing that it could penetrate the dense darkness of the foliage. It was a lovely morning. Going on further and further, before I was aware of it, I had reached the further end of the copse and came out on the river Moskva. It flowed at the bottom of the hill 200 paces below. On the opposite bank of the river they were mowing. I watched whole rows of sharp scythes gleam all together in the sunlight at every swing of the mower and then vanish again, like little fiery snakes going into hiding. I watched the cut grass flying on one side in dense, rich swathes and being laid in long, straight lines. I don't know how long I spent in contemplation. At last I was roused from my reverie by hearing a horse snorting and impatiently pawing the ground 20 paces from me in the track which ran from the high road to the manor house. I don't know whether I heard this horse as soon as the rider rode up and stopped there, or whether the sound had long been in my ears without rousing me from my dreaming. Moved by curiosity, I went into the copse, and before I had gone many steps, I caught the sound of voices speaking rapidly, though in subdued tones. I went up closer, carefully parting the branches of the bushes that edged the path, and at once sprang back in amazement. I caught a glimpse of a familiar white dress, and a soft, feminine voice resounded like music in my heart. It was Madame M. She was standing beside a man on horseback, who, stooping down from the saddle, was hurriedly talking to her, and to my amazement I recognized him as N., the young man who had gone away the morning before, and over whose departure Monsieur M. had been so busy. But people had said at the time that he was going far away to somewhere in the south of Russia, and so I was very much surprised at seeing him with us again so early, and alone with Madame M. She was moved and agitated as I had never seen her before, and tears were glistening on her cheeks. The young man was holding her hand and stooping down to kiss it. I had come upon them at the moment of parting. They seemed to be in haste. At last he took out of his pocket a sealed envelope, gave it to Madame M., put one arm round her, still not dismounting, and gave her a long, fervent kiss. A minute later he lashed his horse and flew past me like an arrow. Madame M. looked after him for some moments, then, pensively and disconsolately, turned homewards. But after going a few steps along the track, she seemed suddenly to recollect herself, hurriedly parted the bushes, and walked on through the copse. I followed her, surprised and perplexed by all that I had seen. My heart was beating violently, as though from terror. I was, as it were, benumbed and befogged. My ideas were shattered and turned upside down, but I remember I was, for some reason, very sad. I got glimpses from time to time through the green foliage of her white dress before me. I followed her mechanically, never losing sight of her, though I trembled at the thought that she might notice me. At last she came out on the little path that led to the house. After waiting half a minute, I too emerged from the bushes. But what was my amazement when I saw lying on the red sand of the path a sealed packet which I recognized from the first glance as the one that had been given to Madame M. 10 minutes before. I picked it up. On both sides the paper was blank. There was no address on it. The envelope was not large, but it was fat and heavy, as though there were three or more sheets of notepaper in it. What was the meaning of this envelope? No doubt it would explain the whole mystery. Perhaps in it there was said all that N. had scarcely hoped to express in their brief, hurried interview. He had not even dismounted. Whether he had been in haste, or whether he had been afraid of being false to himself at the hour of parting, God only knows. I stopped. Without coming onto the path, threw the envelope in the most conspicuous place on it, and kept my eyes upon it, supposing that Madame M. would notice the loss and come back and look for it. But after waiting 4 minutes, I could stand it no longer. I picked up my find again, put it in my pocket, and set off to overtake Madame M. I came upon her in the big avenue in the garden. She was walking straight towards the house with a swift and hurried step, though she was lost in thought, and her eyes were on the ground. I did not know what to do. Go up to her? Give it her? That would be as good as saying that I knew everything, that I had seen it all. I should betray myself at the first word. And how should I look at her? How would she look at me? I kept expecting that she would discover her loss and return on her tracks. Then I could, unnoticed, have flung the envelope on the path, and she would have found it. But no. We were approaching the house. She had already been noticed. As ill luck would have it, everyone had got up very early that day, because, after the unsuccessful expedition of the evening before, they had arranged something new, of which I had heard nothing. All were preparing to set off, and were having breakfast in the veranda. I waited for 10 minutes, that I might not be seen with Madame M., and, making a circuit of the garden, approached the house from the other side a long time after her. She was walking up and down the veranda with her arms folded, looking pale and agitated, and was obviously trying her utmost to suppress the agonizing, despairing misery which could be plainly discerned in her eyes, her walk, her every movement. Sometimes she went down the veranda steps and walked a few paces among the flower beds in the direction of the garden. Her eyes were impatiently, greedily, even incautiously, seeking something on the sand of the path and on the floor of the veranda. There could be no doubt she had discovered her loss and imagined she had dropped the letter somewhere here near the house. Yes, that must be so. She was convinced of it. Someone noticed that she was pale and agitated, and others made the same remark. She was besieged with questions about her health and condolences. She had to laugh, to jest, to appear lively. From time to time, she looked at her husband, who was standing at the end of the terrace, talking to two ladies, and the poor woman was overcome by the same shudder, the same embarrassment, as on the day of his first arrival. Thrusting my hand into my pocket and holding the letter tight in it, I stood at a little distance from them all, praying to fate that Madame M. should notice me. I longed to cheer her up, to relieve her anxiety, if only by a glance, to say a word to her on the sly. But when she did chance to look at me, I dropped my eyes. I saw her distress, and I was not mistaken. To this day I don't know her secret. I know nothing but what I saw and what I have just described. The intrigue was not such, perhaps, as one might suppose at the first glance. Perhaps that kiss was the kiss of farewell. Perhaps it was the last slight reward for the sacrifice made to her peace and honour. N. was going away. He was leaving her. Perhaps forever. Even that letter I was holding in my hand, who can tell what it contained? How can one judge? And who can condemn? And yet There is no doubt that the sudden discovery of her secret would have been terrible, would have been a fatal blow for her. I still remember her face at that minute. It could not have shown more suffering. To feel, to know, to be convinced, to expect, as though it were one's execution, that in quarter of an hour, in a minute perhaps, all might be discovered. The letter might be found by someone, picked up. There was no address on it. It might be opened, and then... what then? What torture could be worse than what was awaiting her? She moved about among those who would be her judges. In another minute, their smiling, flattering faces would be menacing and merciless. She would read mockery, malice, and icy contempt on those faces, and then her life would be plunged in everlasting darkness, with no dawn to follow. Yes, I did not understand it then as I understand it now. I could only have vague suspicions and misgivings, and a heartache at the thought of her danger, which I could not fully understand. But whatever lay hidden in her secret, much was expiated, if expiation were needed, by those moments of anguish of which I was witness, and which I shall never forget. But then came a cheerful summons to set off. Immediately everyone was bustling about gaily. Laughter and lively chatter were heard on all sides. Within 2 minutes the veranda was deserted. Madame M. declined to join the party, acknowledging at last that she was not well. But thank God, all the others set off, everyone was in haste, and there was no time to worry her with commiseration, inquiries, and advice. A few remained at home. Her husband said a few words to her. She answered that she would be all right directly, that he need not be uneasy, that there was no occasion for her to lie down, that she would go into the garden alone, with me. Here she glanced at me. Nothing could be more fortunate. I flushed with pleasure, with delight. A minute later we were on the way. She walked along the same avenues and paths by which she had returned from the copse, instinctively remembering the way she had come, gazing before her, with her eyes fixed on the ground, looking about intently without answering me, possibly forgetting that I was walking beside her. But when we had already reached the place where I had picked up the letter and the path ended, Madame M. suddenly stopped, and in a voice, faint and weak with misery, said that she felt worse and that she would go home. But when she reached the garden fence, she stopped again and thought a minute. A smile of despair came on her lips, and, utterly worn out and exhausted, resigned and making up her mind to the worst, she turned without a word and retraced her steps, even forgetting to tell me of her intention. My heart was torn with sympathy, and I did not know what to do. We went, or rather I led her, to the place from which, an hour before, I had heard the tramp of a horse and their conversation. Here, close to a shady elm tree, was a seat hewn out of one huge stone, about which grew ivy, wild jasmine, and dog-rose. The whole wood was dotted with little bridges, arbours, grottos, and similar surprises. Madame M. sat down on the bench and glanced unconsciously at the marvellous view that lay open before us. A minute later she opened her book and fixed her eyes upon it without reading, without turning the pages, almost unconscious of what she was doing. It was about 9:30. The sun was already high and was floating gloriously in the deep, dark blue sky, as though melting away in its own light. The mowers were by now far away. They were scarcely visible from our side of the river. Endless ridges of mown grass crept after them in unbroken succession, and from time to time the faintly stirring breeze wafted their fragrance to us. The never-ceasing concert of those who sow not, neither do they reap, and are free as the air they cleave with their sportive wings was all about us. It seemed as though at that moment every flower, every blade of grass was exhaling the aroma of sacrifice,
was saying to its creator, "Father, I am blessed and happy." I glanced at the poor woman who alone was like one dead amidst all this joyous life. Two big tears hung motionless on her lashes, wrung from her heart by bitter grief. It was in my power to relieve and console this poor fainting heart, only I did not know how to approach the subject, how to take the first step. I was in agonies. 100 times I was on the point of going up to her, but every time my face glowed like fire. Suddenly, a bright idea dawned upon me. I had found a way of doing it. I revived. "Would you like me to pick you a nosegay?" I said, in such a joyful voice that Madame M. immediately raised her head and looked at me intently. "Yes, do," she said at last in a weak voice, with a faint smile, at once dropping her eyes on the book again. "Or soon they will be mowing the grass here, and there will be no flowers," I cried, eagerly setting to work. I had soon picked my nosegay, a poor, simple one. I should have been ashamed to take it indoors, but how light my heart was as I picked the flowers and tied them up. The dog rose and the wild jasmine I picked closer to the seat. I knew that not far off there was a field of rye not yet ripe. I ran there for cornflowers. I mixed them with tall ears of rye, picking out the finest and most golden. Close by, I came upon a perfect nest of forget-me-nots, and my nosegay was almost complete. Farther away in the meadow there were dark blue campanulas and wild pinks, and I ran down to the very edge of the river to get yellow water-lilies. At last, making my way back and going for an instant into the wood to get some bright green fan-shaped leaves of the maple to put round the nosegay, I happened to come across a whole family of pansies, close to which, luckily for me, the fragrant scent of violets betrayed the little flower hiding in the thick, lush grass and still glistening with drops of dew. The nosegay was complete. I bound it round with fine long grass, which twisted into a rope, and I carefully lay the letter in the centre, hiding it with the flowers, but in such a way that it could be very easily noticed if the slightest attention were bestowed upon my nosegay. I carried it to Madame M. On the way, it seemed to me that the letter was lying too much in view. I hid it a little more. As I got nearer, I thrust it still further in the flowers, and finally, when I was on the spot, I suddenly poked it so deeply into the centre of the nosegay that it could not be noticed at all from outside. My cheeks were positively flaming. I wanted to hide my face in my hands and run away at once, but she glanced at my flowers as though she had completely forgotten that I had gathered them. Mechanically, almost without looking, she held out her hand and took my present, but at once laid it on the seat as though I had handed it to her for that purpose, and dropped her eyes to the book again, seemingly lost in thought. I was ready to cry at this mischance. If only my nosegay were close to her, I thought. If only she had not forgotten it. I lay down on the grass not far off, put my right arm under my head, and closed my eyes as though I were overcome by drowsiness. But I waited, keeping my eyes fixed on her. 10 minutes passed. It seemed to me that she was getting paler and paler. Fortunately, a blessed chance came to my aid. There was a big golden bee, brought by a kindly breeze. Luckily for me, it buzzed over my head and then flew up to Madame M. She waved it off once or twice, but the bee grew more and more persistent. At last, Madame M. snatched up my nosegay and waved it before my face. At that instant, the letter dropped out from among the flowers and fell straight upon the open book. I started. For some time, Madame M., mute with amazement, stared first at the letter and then at the flowers which she was holding in her hands, and she seemed unable to believe her eyes. All at once she flushed, started, and glanced at me,
but I caught her movement, and I shut my eyes tight, pretending to be asleep. Nothing would have induced me to look her straight in the face at that moment. My heart was throbbing and leaping like a bird in the grasp of some village boy. I don't remember how long I lay with my eyes shut, 2 or 3 minutes. At last I ventured to open them. Madame M. was greedily reading the letter, and from her glowing cheeks, her sparkling, tearful eyes, her bright face, every feature of which was quivering with joyful emotion, I guessed that there was happiness in the letter, and all her misery was dispersed like smoke. An agonizing, sweet feeling gnawed at my heart. It was hard for me to go on pretending. I shall never forget that minute. Suddenly, a long way off, we heard voices.
"Madame M! Natalie! Natalie!"
Madame M. did not answer, but she got up quickly from the seat, came up to me and bent over me. I felt that she was looking straight into my face. My eyelashes quivered, but I controlled myself and did not open my eyes. I tried to breathe more evenly and quietly, but my heart smothered me with its violent throbbing. Her burning breath scorched my cheeks. She bent down to my face as though trying to make sure. At last, a kiss and tears fell on my hand, the one which was lying on my breast.
"Natalie! Natalie, where are you?"
we heard again, this time quite close.
"Coming,"
said Madame M., in her mellow, silvery voice, which was so choked and quivering with tears and so subdued that no one but I could hear that coming. But at that instant my heart at last betrayed me and seemed to send all my blood rushing to my face. At that instant a swift, burning kiss scalded my lips. I uttered a faint cry. I opened my eyes, but at once the same gauze kerchief fell upon them, as though she meant to screen me from the sun. An instant later she was gone. I heard nothing but the sound of rapidly retreating steps. I was alone. I pulled off her kerchief and kissed it, beside myself with rapture. For some moments I was almost frantic, hardly able to breathe. Leaning on my elbow on the grass, I stared unconsciously before me at the surrounding slopes, streaked with cornfields, at the river that flowed twisting and winding far away, as far as the eye could see, between fresh hills and villages that gleamed like dots all over the sunlit distance, at the dark blue, hardly visible forests which seemed as though smoking at the edge of the burning sky, and a sweet stillness inspired by the triumphant peacefulness of the picture gradually brought calm to my troubled heart. I felt more at ease and breathed more freely, but my whole soul was full of a dumb, sweet yearning, as though a veil had been drawn from my eyes, as though at a foretaste of something. My frightened heart, faintly quivering with expectation, was groping timidly and joyfully towards some conjecture. And all at once my bosom heaved, began aching, as though something had pierced it, and tears, sweet tears, gushed from my eyes. I hid my face in my hands, and, quivering like a blade of grass, gave myself up to the first consciousness and revelation of my heart, the first vague glimpse of my nature. My childhood was over from that moment. When 2 hours later I returned home, I did not find Madame M. Through some sudden chance, she had gone back to Moscow with her husband. I never saw her again.